This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Felberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly, and I am hungry just thinking about tonight's show. We are starting off with something sweet and savory, and it can be the best part of your entire weekend when you find the right one. It is brunch. We've got some great ones here in Las Vegas, and Las Vegas Weekly food critic John Curtis is here to tell me all about some of his favorites. Thanks so much for being here, John.
Happy to be here, and I'm hungry.
Me too, just actually.
Just like you.
So when I think brunch, a lot of times I think buffets, like the big Vegas buffet spreads.
I hate buffets. You know.
But there's more to brunch than buffets these days.
Yeah, well, brunch is becoming kind of an art form among restaurants. I mean, it used to be sort of the throwaway, just kind of, is it breakfast, is it lunch, eggs, bacon, omelets, maybe eggs Benedict. Now all these restaurants are really taking it to a different level, which is kind of fun, which is what we're talking about in the Las Vegas Weekly this week.
Definitely. We have a rundown of all of the best brunches in town. Things that range from your French varieties to Mexican to Asian, even some Indian, really incredible food. What are some of your personal favorites?
Well, we did we have about a dozen or so of the top ones in town. I personally love Bar Plus Bistro as a new place in town. This is the space in the Arts Factory, downtown Arts Factory.
Right.
It has been a number of restaurants over the last 10 years, all of them, I wouldn't say failures, but let's say underperformers some level, okay?
That's generous.
To be kind, okay? Well, now they have this nice new chef, great new chef, Benny Velasquez, young guy, Spanish-Mexican fellow, and who is doing, just taking it to a level with Spanish tapas, Mexican food, and not your standard tortilla kind of food. I mean, really, really interesting things. His brunch specialty is something called, and you're going to help me because you speak Spanish.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, it's called Cangrejo Benedict Mofongo.
That was pretty good. I'm not even going to correct you.
How's that? It's basically a crab cake on top of mashed plantains with garlic with a quail egg on top, and it comes out, it's gorgeous. It's almost like a round vertical little eggs Benedict with a tiny egg, but it's just wonderful.
That sounds like so many of my favorite ingredients stacked on top of each other.
And it shows some artfulness, and it's tasty. It's not too much. I mean, too much of brunch food has been considered too heavy, but I really like that. I'm also really, really big on Mozen, written about by Jim Bagley, because Mozen in the Mandarin Oriental does some of the best Indian food in town. And they offer that at brunch, which is great. Simon, of course, Carrie Simon is a favorite. But for pure romance and pure Sunday afternoon, lounging the afternoon away, nothing beats Marche Bacchus.
Oh, certainly. Tell me a little bit about the setting at Marche Bacchus.
Okay, if you've never been to Marche Bacchus, folks, I mean, first of all, have you ever met a woman who doesn't love Marche Bacchus? I mean, you've been there, right, Sarah?
I certainly have, number of times.
You sit out by it's a fake lake, but it's a gorgeous fake lake, and you sit out by the lake, and it's fresh air, and it's outdoors, and it's in the shade, and they have nice misters. They have this gorgeous wine program where the wine store is part of the restaurant, so you just pick a bottle of wine, pay $10 over retail, take it out to your table. They have a new chef, Joe Swan, who apprenticed under Alex Strada at Alex and the Wynn, the now defunct Wynn, and he's bringing his Franco-Mediterranean spin to all of his brunch classics. I mean, he does the classic Eggs Benedict and things like that, but he's also making his own house-made sausages. I mean, they're really taking it to a different level at Marche Bacchus. So, plus, it's probably one of the best deals in town.
Sure. Yeah. Deals are important. And I know there's another sort of venerable sort of French favorite that was on our list for this week, and that's the Venetian.
The Bouchon.
Well, certainly.
Bouchon is, it's hard to beat Bouchon. I mean, Thomas Keller's crew there probably has done the seminal brunch in terms of taking brunch to a different level. They've been doing it longer and better than anyone. I mean, everyone's kind of getting with the program now, but 5 years ago, Bouchon was baking all its own breads. I mean, the pastry basket there with the sticky bun and the pain au chocolat and the croissant, which tastes just from the left bank of Paris, it's just out of this world. And it's one of the tougher reservations to get to.
And what about Thomas Keller himself? He's an absolutely incredible chef. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, he's sort of Thomas Keller is sort of like the passionate, almost devoted monk of fine chefs. Okay, he's a celebrity chef, but you don't see him on television. You don't see him giving many interviews. I mean, you'll see in a magazine article here or there. The critics love him, the diners love him, but he has a monk-like devotion to great food, and you can taste that in all of his restaurants because his kitchen staff and the wait staff just bring it to that level all the time because they're not about, you know, seeing him on TV, seeing him on Bravo or the Food Network, but it's all about how good is the food. He's a Francophile himself. He'll tell you that straight up. I've interviewed him many times, and he just wants to make American French food as good or better than he's had it in France. And by and large, Bouchon in the Venetian does that.
That's fantastic. And he's obviously known for the French Laundry in California. And I had read somewhere recently, I think it was on Eater.com, that to celebrate the French Laundry's anniversary this year, they actually had burgers brought in from In-N-Out. And I just loved that image of the kitchen staff at the French Laundry eating In-N-Out for lunch.
Well, I don't know. And I'm an In-N-Out. All food critics are In-N-Out fans. I don't know why they would do that when Taylor's Refresher is right there in downtown St. Helena. But In-N-Out's great. And he's a grounded guy. And he's not about anything but the food. And he has, like, the devotion of his staff is amazing. He has the same chefs year in and year out. Something you don't see in restaurants of that caliber. And so, I mean, it's hard to go wrong with Bouchon. And they also have one of the better wine programs in town, too.
Ah, excellent. That's an added bonus. And speaking of wine, sometimes what you really need at brunch is, the food is great, the food is important, but what you really need is a good cocktail.
Sounds like we're getting into Sarah Feldberg territory.
My Sunday morning.
I need a drink. Yeah, I guess I'm a Bloody Mary fan. But I like them on Sunday brunches as well as anyone. And probably they go better with Sunday brunch than wine, okay? Because, you know, you've got eggs and pancakes and French toast, and like they do the Bar Plus Bistro does a flan French toast, which is out of this world.
Sounds fantastic.
And you need something probably with a little more kick to it to cut through that than even a good red or white wine. So where are some of the great Bloody Marys? I think the gold standard for Bloody Mary is the Downtown Dill, okay, which you can't get it on Saturday and Sunday mornings.
Because the Downtown Cocktail Room, which serves it, is closed.
It doesn't open till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But let me tell you, folks, if you get a chance, the Downtown Cocktail Room's Downtown Dill, they actually strain the tomato juice. It becomes like a tomato water. And then they add, let me make sure I get this right, Plymouth gin, muddled cucumbers, and a house-made Bloody Mary mix with fresh dill. That just, and then they coat the rim with salt and dill. And it makes you want to drink more. That's how good it is. It's enough to make an alcoholic out of you. That's how good it is. Hash House of Go-Go, believe it or not, has a good one too. But Hash House is, I don't go there as much as I should. I'm trying to think who else has great ones. RM Seafood has one of the best Bloody Marys in town. And they have quite a brunch at the Downstairs Cafe. They're very seafood oriented more than anything else. But they have a very aggressive bar program there, which does a nice job too.
That's excellent. And speaking of sort of different brunches, RM Seafood, a seafood-focused brunch, Border Grill recently has started doing their brunch as well.
Mike Miner is the chef there, and he does it with Mike and the two hot tamales he works for, Susan Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken, really bring a very Mexican-influenced brunch menu. I mean, he roasts his own pigs, whole pigs. He roasts his own goats. Believe it or not, he has goat stew for brunch sometimes.
That is awesome.
You know, I mean, Mike takes it. Mike's just a chef, a kind of a passionate, crazy. He's crazy, but in a good way for a chef, because he's always looking to sort of take a typical dish, whether it's a enchilada or a burrito, and just take it to a different planet.
And they do the style of brunch there that I really love, because you have your all-you-can-eat buffets where oftentimes some of the food is sitting out for a while and maybe isn't as fresh as you'd like.
You don't like steam table food?
You know what? I don't. I really, it just doesn't get me going. But then you also have your a la carte buffets, and they land somewhere in the middle where all the food is a la carte, but it's also all you can eat. So if you go in a Border Grill, you order off the menu, but it just keeps coming and coming and coming, literally until you say, no more, I can't handle it.
I think Carrie Simon does the same thing, doesn't he?
Simon? He does. And tell me about the Simon brunch. That's a Vegas favorite.
Well, that's where I like to go to Girl Watch, okay? I mean, not that you know anything about that, but if you want to see hot women in their underwear, I mean,
in the morning.
In the morning. It's called the pajama brunch. Have you ever eaten there in your pajamas?
You know what? Okay, so the first day it opened, it was New Year's Day a couple years ago, and I was at the Palms all night long working, covering New Year's Eve.
Yeah, all night long working at the Palms.
It was hard.
Who's buying that?
It was hard work, but someone had to do it. And I literally, I put on my pajamas in the morning, not having slept a minute, and walked over thinking everyone is going to be kind of a mess with their hair down, faces undone, in their PJs. PJs is loosely interpreted. Your sexiest lingerie will be appropriate. Don't show up in your footy pajamas and bedroom slippers.
Yeah, your PJs if you have your clippy-cloppy heels on, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. And your little teddies. Hey, from a guy's standpoint, it's great.
And the food's
not bad either. Yeah, the food's not. And what I like about Carrie's Simon's brunch at Simon is he has a great little kids menu too, which a really nice,
really?
All kinds of like smaller portions and crazy little cereals and muffins and French toast and things like that for kids, which is nice. He also has a really nice Japanese.
Sushi bar.
I'm choking on this one. On sushi, sashimi, so you can get an Asian influence if you actually want to eat lighter instead of just filling up on pancakes and bacon.
Sure. And Carrie himself is actually a really healthy eater.
He's disgustingly handsome and in good shape for a chef. I can handle that.
I don't know if you've tried his granola, but he makes his own granola and does these yogurt parfaits. They're very worth checking out, somewhere in between your, you know, egg pizza and French toast and all the rest.
I'm usually too busy looking at the women to, notice his granola.
Fair enough. And what about, I know dim sum is one of my personal favorites for a Sunday morning.
Well, this is where, I mean, I like the selection in this week's weekly, the Las Vegas Weekly's brunch menu cover story, which is great.
Yeah.
And you have Cathay House, which is an old, tried and true reliable. And they do a really nice standard dim sum breakfast and brunch. But I also like Ping Pang Pong, which didn't make it into the weekly because I guess I either got lazy or Jim Bagley just decided to, Brock Radke didn't get a chance to get over there. But they both do, I mean, all the things that they have for the Chinese invented this kind of eating.
You know, sure.
Small bites, dumplings, har gao, shrimp dumplings, little shumai pork dumplings, cha su bao, small little pork buns that you nibble on. You can eat a great meal. Not fill up and eat healthy and not too fattening. You know, the Chinese got there thousands of years before the rest of us.
And tell me a little bit about the way dim sum works, because it's not quite the way we're used to eating in America, and it can be a little intimidating if you've never done it before.
Well, you pretty much just point. You yell and point, which is tough for a gringo. but here's the way it works at Cathay House and Ping Pang Pong. You sit down, and they put a bill of fare like a ticket right next to you, and it'll be blank, and you just point to the different steamer baskets or baskets you want, and they will just put a mark on your bill.
Okay.
And they bill you by the number of baskets that you order. Most of them come in their baskets, whether there are vegetarian dumplings or pork buns or whatever. They come in groups of three because that's kind of a lucky number for them, and you whatever looks good. You point to, they bring to the table, and then the waitress will simply stamp your little ticket that shows that that's you how many baskets you got. They count them up, and they charge you by the basket. Most of the baskets cost about the same. One big point for anyone eating dim sum, when they look at you and say, you know, like, you pretty much have, take their word for it, folks. Unless you're an adventuresome restaurant critic or Sarah Feldberg, if they say you know, like... stay away from the chicken feet and the blood pudding.
I'll admit that even I can't handle the chicken feet.
And you don't like the gelatinous blood pudding, big chunks of pork blood in your pudding?
I steer clear of that too.
So yeah, dim sum is great. But the best way to, if you've never done dim sum at Cathay House or Ping Pang Pong, best way to go is with someone who's more used to doing it than you. The first time will be intimidating. Once you do it once, it's easy. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining me, John. It was great to have you.
Always great to be here. Always great to work with the weekly. And the brunch has gotten me hungry.
I know. Me too.
Yeah, I know. Let's go get something to eat.
You can read all of John's and all of our other food critic selections for the best brunches in Las Vegas in this week's issue of Las Vegas Weekly. And you can read more from John at eatinglasvegas.com. We'll be back with more of Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag in just a minute.
This is April Corbin with the Las Vegas Weekly Radio Mag. I am speaking with UNLV's former president, Carol Harder. And today we are here to talk a little bit about the funding formula at UNLV and how the state handles higher education funding. How are you today, Dr. Harder?
I'm very good, April. How are you?
I am fantastic. You have a unique relationship with the funding formula in terms of, because you were involved with some funding studies years ago, correct?
Yeah, that's true. We got involved in that originally because there was no formula for higher education. It was entirely done politically. That is, you came in and you made your pitch to the legislature, and they essentially gave you what they thought you should have. So it wasn't a really rational system with any rational drivers of the numbers. It was essentially a totally political system. So it was very clear to me pretty quickly after I became president in 1995 that a more rational system needed to be created, and I think lots of other people shared that point of view. So this goes back now 15 or 16 years, and even before that, in terms of the concern about how higher education was funded.
Yeah, and I think people can't imagine sort of that system going on right now.
It does. You know, April, it still does in terms of capital budgets. Capital is still a political process. You come in and you make the best argument you can and you persuade the politicians who are most favorable to your particular institution. So the capital budget is not based on space needs, which UNLV has greatly, and so does CCSN. It's, again, based on the old political who your friends are. So it's not completely solved yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the funding formula, which worked well during the very big growth years, hasn't worked terribly well in the last few years. And I think lots of folks share a sense that it needs to be tinkered with again.
Yeah, and one issue that I have found when talking to people about the funding formula and the problems they have with it is this idea that most of the funding formula is based only on enrollment versus performance issues like graduation rates and sort of that kind of incentive funding.
Yeah, there's no incentive funding built into the formula except for growth. There are also other things missing, like there's no research funding whatsoever. There's no acknowledgement of a research mission, which would actually fund your PhD programs at a considerably higher level than they're currently funded. And there's the mixture between community colleges and universities in the same formula matrix makes absolutely no sense. We are either the only state in the union that does that, or we're one of very few. And the reason for that is that what happens is that everything gets pushed to the middle. In other words, community colleges are funded higher than they are in most states, and universities are funded lower. And part of that is because community colleges here do not get support from their local counties, which they should be getting, and offsetting some of the state support that the universities should be getting that right now goes to community colleges. So there are lots of different things wrong with the formula.
Yeah, and I believe that years ago they'd brought it up in the county commission that sort of some property taxes should be allocated to but it sort of fell by the wayside. And then now with budget cuts sort of being around the block and sort of everywhere, no one's ever going to sort of think about that right now.
Yeah, I don't know whether they will. Now, the legislature, I'm sure you know this, the legislature in this last session has already agreed to appoint a legislative committee to study that whole issue again. Whether they go back this time to the counties, as they're studying all of the drivers that are in the formulas, they'll notice that community colleges aren't receiving any support from the counties they're in. And again, given many other states, most other states, as I understand it, the counties do supply some of the funding, and therefore the state piece can be reduced and reallocated to the universities. Mm-hmm. So it's a really complex issue.
Yeah, and some people have suggested to me that one of the underlying issues regarding this is this idea that goes back to North versus Southern Nevada. I mean, would you agree with that at all?
Absolutely, I would. the politics have been, for eons now, favored the northern institutions. In terms of the number of dollars per student that are provided by the state, the northern institutions trump the southern institutions hugely. And UNR, Elko, Great Basin College, WNCC particularly, get much more funding per student than UNLV does. Mm-hmm. Here we are, a research institution, and two of those three institutions are not research institutions, and yet they get more money than we do. So yeah. CCSN and UNLV have been at the short end of the stick for many years, and I think people will tell you it's political. Again, it's who was running the legislature all of those years when those decisions were being made, and it wasn't the Southern legislators.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And we actually sort of crunch those numbers and have some of the things that are in this week's issue of the Weekly, just showing the difference between, for every dollar that UNLV raises in tuition, they're getting $1.24 back from the state versus UNR, which is over $2. And sort of, I guess the question that gets raised is how people have allowed this sort of broken system to go along. And I think a lot of it maybe goes back to the fact that just back when Clark County was doing really well and booms, people weren't concerned with education. But now I think people are starting to wake up to this idea that we need to fix these equity issues.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think the politics in our legislature have changed. And so Southern legislators are going to have a lot more influence. And I think that will make a difference right there. Plus, that, you know, when you had huge growth in the South, CCSN and UNLV both, it was kind of masking the inequity issue that was still at the heart of things. UNR was not growing nearly as rapidly, or WNCC, as either CCSN or UNLV. So you got new money, but it was based entirely on that growth, and it masked the fact that you were getting, in our case, $2,000 less per student than UNR was getting. So it was the minute the growth slowed down because of all the economic turmoil we've had and the costs of higher education going up so much, it unmasked this problem. On the other hand, it deepened the issue because the state has no money. So the problem becomes, how do you solve this fundamental issue without taking away from some of the other institutions? See, I would never advocate taking away. I would say what we need to do is give $2 for every $1 to the schools that are underfunded until they are more equitably funded, rather than taking literally away from any other institution. You can't really do that without it being catastrophic. So you've got to increase the increases for the, maybe double them for 10 years or so that you finally reach equity that way.
Yeah, and I think that it's because it's a complicated issue to fix and because it takes time. And really, it seems to come down to the fact that Nevada sort of needs to step it up and it needs an influx of money. And it goes back to this. Yeah. And another thing that people have brought up is just what sort of economic impact UNLV could have if it were a better institution in certain areas, or if it was able to keep its residents here. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that in terms of just how UNLV or any institution in an urban community could actually benefit by bringing in white-collar workers and all of those kind of things.
Absolutely. And every other state that has the population that we have in the area has at least two major research institutions, if not considerably more than two. In some cases, Colorado, I think, has seven. So think about where we are as a state in terms of our culture and in terms of our economic impact. And it's very clear to me that higher education is the primary engine for these things. And starving it to death, like we are doing right now, is simply cutting off our nose to spite our face. See, all the business people say, don't tax us during these hard times. Well, if you want help, if you want trained employees, if you want new people in new industries like biotechnology and some of the high engineering areas and computing areas, you got to have college and university trained personnel. And so you've got to fund the darn thing to get it to the point where it can actually contribute to the economy. I've puzzled a lot about why people don't see the connection. between those things.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people suggest that it comes down to the fact that only, you know, one out of every five individuals here living in Nevada have a college degree.
That's correct. So the perceptions of those people are that you don't need them. And I think in terms of the gaming business, minus the managerial staff, in the past at least, it has been true that you could make a very good living as a dealer or as a back-of-the-house person or a person in food service, and you still probably can without a degree. But the complexity of the technology now in gaming and in hotel administration and management is such that even in the lower-end jobs, people are advanced when they have formal education that takes them further. They know more. They're able to conceptualize more what needs to be done, especially in a crisis like this. In a crisis, you need creative, really thoughtful people. So, again, I think it's our past, our history. Nevada has never been a state that's really put big dollars into education, either K through 12 or higher ed, and that it's got to change its perspective, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just to build off what you were saying in terms of gaming with internet gaming and that sort of industry really budding up, that's going to need a lot of resources that UNLV right now wouldn't be able to, but we should in terms of if we want to be profitable in the future.
We hope so. And I thank goodness we have a really first-rate hotel administration school, but that certainly does help the industry. But we'd have to branch out as a community and as a state. When you have 2 million people in your city, you've got to have at least one, if not more than one, major university feeding the needs of these folks in healthcare and pharmaceuticals and biotech and, you know, security technology, all of these things that require really highly educated folks.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are just issues that are really important here. I mean, a lot's been said about our healthcare system, and the impact is sort of so wide range that it's really hard to. But hopefully, with the committee that they're forming, and hopefully some changes will be made. Do you feel like there is hope for the future, and that sort of changes are going to be made, or do you see a lot of the same?
I don't. I'm very hopeful that finally. I don't think there are too many people, even people who are rooted in the North, both politically or otherwise, that don't recognize that we're at the point where you can no longer treat the two universities, for example, as if they didn't have the same aspirations and the same potential to be great research universities. We're no longer the stepchild of UNR. You know, that's been true for years and years and years, that way of thinking. I don't think many people think that anymore. I think what they're afraid of is that if UNLV gets more funding, it'll take it away from UNR, where I think we have to come up with some kind of a process that allows UNLV to get more money per student for this X number of years in the future to get it closer to parity with UNR.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And obviously, this is only the very beginning of a very long discussion about higher education. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your thoughts.
And I'd be glad to join you again if you want to follow up with this even further, April. I think it's a very important subject for our state.
All right, absolutely. Thank you so much, Carol.
Okay, April.
You can read more about this issue in this issue of the Las Vegas Weekly out on newsstands now or at thelasvegasweekly.com anytime. We'd like to thank our guests, John Curtis and Carol Harder, for joining us today. I want to thank our producer, Stephen Zeller, and tune in next week at 5:30 again for Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag.